Hi everyone, it's Adam from Monkey Tennis here. Just saying a huge thank you to all of you that have supported my charity appeal so far. For those that haven't heard about it, this September I'm going to be swimming 15 kilometres between five islands in Cornwall. I'll be swimming the Isles of Scilly, that's Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. I'm doing it because I want to, but also to raise money for CALM, the campaign against living miserably. It's a well-known statistic that 125 people in the UK die by suicide every week, and CALM run a free and confidential helpline for people to speak through their problems and ultimately to help prevent suicides. I'm looking to raise enough money to train two new phone workers to man those lines, and I'll be doing it by swimming the Isles of Scilly in Cornwall. If you're looking to support me, it would be greatly appreciated. You can donate at justgiving.com. Just go there and search for Adam Swim Scilly. That's Adam Swim Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. All donations greatly appreciated. Thank you for helping me to support CALM. And now, on with Monkey Tennis.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And this is the beauty of podcasting, the freedom of the medium.
Kukumpa.
Monkey tennis?
Bring, bring.
Fireworks. Don't muck about.
Trees are my pawn.
Monkey tennis?
Ready, steady, fuck off.
Scratch me!
Are you being served?
Monkey tennis?
Excuse me, your dog's taken my dog's stick. With a chuckle, with a chuckle.
Monkey tennis?
Yep, absolutely. Yep, 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 absolutely.
Generally, I think new ideas are bad.
Monkey tennis?
Why not consider chips?
You must come and stay in the barn. Fuck off.
Riddle me that, you nutters. Nothing refreshes like an ice-cold glass of milk.
Nah.
Monkey tennis?
From the host house.
Keep it down, love.
Hello, friends, and welcome to Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge fan podcast. I'm Adam Brooks, and I'm joined by Tom Dark.
Check your balls, check the inside of your bum, message over.
Nick Alder.
It's a fun, funky way to firm up your bum.
And Tom Stab.
Like all churches, there are one or two racists.
So, welcome to once another Monkey Tennis. We'll be diving into episodes 8 and 9 of Alan's podcast from the Host House very shortly. We thought it was worth mentioning at the top of the episode, we recently sailed past episode 100. We've been doing this for 4 years, and if you would like to show your appreciation, we would certainly love to receive it in the form of a coffee or a Ko-fi. If you'd like to shout us the price of a cup of coffee, or maybe be very generous and give us 5 coffees, one for each member of the team, you can do so at ko-fi.com/monkeytennis. Thanks in advance for your huge generosity. Before we dive into the main bulk of today's episode, we thought it was we're deep enough into the Host House to maybe look at some of the coverage, the press coverage and the interviews that Steve Coogan's given around the project, and see if there's a few more tidbits that we can glean from those. So starting with Mr. Tom Stab, I believe, who had a look at LinkedIn.
Yeah, so I mean, I think less to do with sort of promo and in that sort of world. It's more, I think this is something that possibly the marketing team at Audible have put together. And Alan is officially on LinkedIn. He, what's the name of the? He's a premium user. That's it. He's a, of course he's a premium user.
Of course he is. Just him and Bruno Brooks. We've learned.
So yeah, if you search for the real Alan Partridge on LinkedIn, you'll be able to find him. And there's some nice little tidbits here, which I think have sort of the hallmarks of the Gibbons writing. So I think they may have put together a few little bits for this. So I'll just quickly read the about section and then go into what other gold you can find on the profile. So yeah, this is the about section. Alan Partridge is an experienced, dynamic, versatile broadcaster who has joined LinkedIn not to hustle for work. He has work, very good work. He doesn't need work, but to cock a snook at those LinkedIn users who have snubbed him in the past. You know who you are. You might be Valerie from Corsadil Mouthwash, who decided I wasn't big enough to keep on as a brand ambassador, or one of the Oxbridge graduates at Endemol who say they'll call me back and then don't. Or any of the idiots at Carphone Warehouse or Channel 4 or Dave. To you people, I say, here, have a business card, and then reach into my pocket as if to get one out, and then I take my hand out, and there's no card, just my middle finger. That works better in person. Thank you. And then there's a few bits on the page, which I won't go into specific details on. You can have a look at it in your own time. But there's a Think Yourself Creative thought piece that Alan has written. And then also there's some gold in the experience section to find as well. So I recommend going onto LinkedIn and finding Alan Partridge's profile. And also, if you do add him, he will accept you. So I am connected to Alan Partridge on LinkedIn.
And isn't there, there's like a whole list of his previous jobs or something, aren't there, when it's kind of like coded messages?
Yeah, it's very good. There's some good little nuggets there, which I'll let people discover in their own time. Because I did try reading it through sort of out loud before we recorded the podcast. It's difficult to explain. You have to kind of read it to understand how it's sort of formatted and laid out to get the gag. So I recommend doing that in your own time.
Cool. A couple of bits that I've spotted over the last couple of weeks as well. Digital Spy had a short piece about Oasthouse, and I just thought it was quite interesting. They had some quotes from Coogan here revealing that they've had to be careful filling in the character's backstory in the podcast because it's all too easy to get things wrong. So the quote from Coogan, we have to be careful because the more we fill in, when you have a blank page, you can be inventive. You can be a little cavalier with your choices because you're not hostage to any pre-existing facts. The more facts you put out into the story, you have to respect them, and sometimes you'll slip up. It continues, there are anecdotal things that could have happened to him, but the writers didn't want to have to change anything by missing something important. So just thought it's quite interesting that they're acknowledging the fact that, I guess, the character's backstory now goes on for the best part of 30 years. Even they know that it's going to be very easy for them to get things wrong, make something inconsistent, slip up with things. And I think, you know, when you look at something like the character's age, for example, even think mistakes around that will come into play over the next few episodes.
Sounds like a man living in fear of four super sleuths on a podcast, ready to pull apart the Alan Partridge timeline.
And speaking of which, Steve Coogan was also on the Empire podcast. I think quite often people ask us, do you know if Steve Coogan knows that Monkey Tennis exists? Do you know if he's heard of it? And I think now we have this short extract from his interview on Empire to play people, and you can make up your own minds.
I mean, there are a lot of very thin, flimsy podcasts out there, frankly.
It's like
could that be a thinly veiled comment on Monkey Tennis? We'll never know. A couple of interesting things that Coogan said in that interview. So he kind of talks about the way Alan is now in 2020, that he's not completely out of step. He's just slightly out of step. He talked about some of his favourite moments from across the APU. In particular, he noted Scissored Isle being one of his favourite shows, the Mid-Morning Matters shows being highlights for him. And also he did specifically highlight the Jill episode of I'm Alan Partridge. He also did go on to talking about Alan Mark II in terms of the Gibbon era Alan, as enjoying Mark II Alan more because there's more subtlety and there's more pathos to that character, whereas Mark I Alan is essentially an idiot, which I think we'd probably all broadly agree with.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's something we've mentioned before as well. Moving on, there was a Guardian interview, which is a lot of fun because it's presented as an interview with Alan himself rather than an interview with Steve. And it's very lengthy. It does lift some kind of quotes and segments that you will hear on the Oasthouse podcast as well. But there are a couple of bits that I thought built Alan's world a little bit more that I would mention. Firstly, it seems that they give almost a specific location of the Oasthouse. To quote, it says, turn right out of Norwich Railway Station, take the number 12 bus, change at Norfolk and Norwich University Hospital, ride 8 stops on the number 4 towards Swanton Morley, walk 1.1 miles, and you can't help but spot the twin louvred conical towers of the Oasthouse that Alan Partridge calls home. So I expect a listener with perhaps more time and inclination on their hands than me can follow that route and try and work out the specific location of Alan's Oasthouse and do let us know.
Oh, that'd be good.
The next bit is a reference to Seldom's insatiable hunger, which I enjoyed a lot. Alan says to the interviewer, "I'd ask that you remove any sandwiches, and if you've handled any such snack in the last hour, wash your hands quietly and well." His dog, he explains, an enormous brown mastiff called Seldom, adores sandwiches. Alan goes on to say, "Less than 0.1% of mastiffs attack. Unfortunately, Seldom's the whole of that 0.1%. The kindest thing I can say is that he's a statistical anomaly." So I enjoyed that bit a lot. And Seldom's hunger gets the better of him throughout this series. He talks a little bit about the potential for more series of From the Oast House. He says he's considering using a second series of his podcast to explore the disappearance of a friend who fell from a pier in 2013. So we obviously know that's Michael Jordy. He says, "I'm just waiting to hear from Audible, as they've yet to say they definitely want a second series. I'm not worried. It's just that they said they'd call, and thus far they haven't. It's fine. They've not called. They've just not called."
That's so good. Yeah. Yet to hear that they definitely will say yes. That's brilliant, yeah.
There's a nice quick throwaway line where he says, "A TV presenter claiming to prefer radio is like a Hollywood actor claiming their first love is the theatre, i.e. a clear and obvious lie." And a little bit of Denise and Fernando detail. The interviewer says, "I interrupt to ask when he last saw his now middle-aged children." Alan replies, "Just before lockdown. They're shielding, so I couldn't visit anyway. Fernando says he had head cancer, and Denise says she's sometimes diabetic." So yeah, his kids don't want to see him. And the final little tidbit from the Guardian article, I thought, was there's a reference to Lynn's driving ban, which I thought was a nice bit of art imitating life, because Steve narrowly avoided a ban earlier in the year, which we've covered on previous episodes. He says, "Partridge suddenly jumps up. Bugger me, I have to collect Lynn from her physio. Ah, yes, Partridge's dedicated assistant Lynn, who's worked for him since the 90s. As Alan continues, "She's just started a 12-month driving ban, so I'm having to ferry her around and subtract the petrol money from her wages. She fell asleep at the wheel after an Irish coffee and crashed into a stationary St. John's ambulance. People you'd expect to be able to cope in the event of a low-speed collision, but their training went out the window and they went to pieces. It was only when a second St. John ambulance arrived that they were able to restore some semblance of order. The judge made an example of her, which I think she was quietly flattered by." So I think there's definitely some parallels there with perhaps with Coogan's own brush with the law over driving offences.
I love when they do these pieces in character, because it just extends the whole world around it, doesn't it? That is a really worthy addition to the whole Oast House podcast itself, stuff like that.
And I felt like they gave quite a lot of specific detail. I feel like when they do bits of press, they normally are careful not to add any colour. But with this, you learn a few things that you wouldn't have got from the podcast.
And I wonder as well, does that mean, did the Gibbons just sit down and write that and just deliver it to the Guardian? Or I wonder whether they actually work with a Guardian journalist to kind of fill it in together. I'd be quite interested to know a bit more about that process, the kind of fictional interviews.
My guess would be that they would offer it as an interview with Alan and explain how that would work. Then they would write most of Alan's responses, or either that or the Guardian would send over questions and they would write responses as Alan. I imagine it's probably written 90% by the Gibbons and then it's sort of Guardianed up into their house style at the end. That's how I imagine it.
You know what, just occurring to me, I feel like they've kind of missed a trick where they could have had Coogan in character on other podcasts. So Alan doing interviews on like Adam Buxton or something like that. That could be quite a lot of fun as well.
I think the problem or challenge with that would be, though, that it's all scripted, isn't it? And so off the cuff and that funny would probably be a challenge. There's one more piece of kind of, I guess, peripheral Partridge updates, which was that on the Simon Mayo and Mark Kermode podcast this week, Simon Mayo talked about the time that he was the subject of a Noel Edmonds gotcha, which I was not familiar that he was. So I took to YouTube and watched the clip. I can't lie, it definitely wasn't the funniest thing I've ever seen. It was basically Simon Mayo being tricked into doing an interview on a unicycle, and then, oh no, we thought that you could ride a unicycle, Simon Mayo, but actually, obviously, he couldn't. So he had to be kind of like held up on this unicycle and conduct an interview whilst on the unicycle. So that was the gist of it. And then, obviously, Edmonds came out and got him. But yeah, a nice little kind of peripheral piece of Partridge news in the wider podcast world this week.
Cool. And I think before we launch into our episode dissection, I've got one more thing. I've got a little Easter egg for us to all try. Now, this worked for me. So hopefully
I love an Easter egg. Is it chocolate?
If you can get, I think so. Everybody should have the Audible app on their phone. If you can open the app and search for Oast House, and hit return, let me know if anything interesting comes up on screen. And if it doesn't, I'll explain what should happen.
Doesn't look very interesting to me.
No. Okay. And what if you click on Oast House, what happens?
Okay.
Okay. Nothing. Apart from it taking me to that.
Just to the episode.
It's just taking me to from the Oast House, and it says, do I want to give it a short sample?
Interesting.
Yeah, I've got that as well.
Okay, so when I did this a few weeks ago, and I have also seen people post this screenshot on Twitter, when I searched for Oast House or from the Oast House, I got a notification that came up, said, congratulations, you've earned the silver High Noon badge. Mm. And then there's a little logo with it, with like the cowboy boots.
I wonder if it's for early adopters.
Yeah, perhaps. Yeah, weird.
If any of our listeners also came across that, let us know.
That's a shame. Thought it might be a bit of fun to try live, but it hasn't worked out.
It's like the confetti cannon.
Yeah, for our 100th episode.
From White City Pyrotechnics.
Yeah. As Tom Stab says, if you did earn the Silver High Noon badge yourself, then do get in touch and let us know. Or maybe you even got in early enough to get a gold. Perhaps there's other badges that we weren't even quick enough for. So let's move on to today's first episode, which is episode 8, subtitled Letters. Here at Monkey Tennis, we're also polite, happy, and we get lots of letters, which you'll know that here on a future feedback episode. But this opens with a sort of an ASMR playground, almost, Partridge opening his mail with a coffee.
A sonic picture, as he calls it.
A noise diagram.
Yeah. So should we go through those noises? You get stirring tea, you get slurping, you get the opening of a letter, you get an R, and then the clatter of a plate. really paints a picture.
Oh, yeah, which is Rosa, his housekeeper, dropping a plate. He says it happens about once a month, but he doesn't mind as long as it's not the good ones.
Yes, which we'll come back to later in the episode, I think.
Yeah, so, you know, he says it doesn't matter if she drops one plate a month, so 12 plates a year. now, correct me if I'm wrong, isn't there quite a good plate-dropping story from when you guys lived together? Didn't Nick drop a whole load of plates and smash them all in the kitchen?
That could have been very serious, to be fair.
Yeah, we nearly lost our deposit, Nick.
We had to clean it up.
Nick was trying to clean a sort of wall-mounted crockery
It's like a dresser.
Holder.
It was like a dresser. Yeah.
On the last day we lived at the property together, and he overreached, had to catch his fall on the crockery holder. The entire thing came off the wall. I reckon he must have smashed about 30 plates, and because it was so late in the day and we had to move out in about an hour's time, we literally just left the shards in a cardboard box in the lounge with the word sorry written on it.
Well,
it wasn't just plates as well, wasn't it? Like plates, bowls, mugs, glasses, it was everything.
But I remember I phoned the landlord straight after it had happened and kind of explained what had just taken place, because we were due to move out in like an hour's time. And I remember him just saying, I don't know what you want me to tell you.
Oh, well, there you go. Just another thing you and Rosa have got in common, that and a love of the Go Compare adverts.
So yeah, with Alan saying who cares if she drops a plate a month, and then he suddenly realises that would mean that's a whole set. So he's suddenly not so keen on that happening.
No.
And he also says that the sound of a man or woman opening letters was a familiar sound up and down the land. I mean, I think when you think about opening letters, would you put that hand in hand with a noise? I'm not sure that I would. It's an action. No. It's an activity. It's not a noise.
I wouldn't really. And he tries to give some other examples of that sort of thing, and there's some nice pronunciation. He describes the whistle of a kettle, which I think is the first HW noise he's made this series, the whistle. And also another sound that he seems to use all the time these days, the bring bring of what he describes as a baker light, but I think he means a bake light. I believe it's pronounced bake light, so that's another one of those Nesquilk, Dracula, Baker-like type pronunciations that we've had.
Oh, I actually don't know. Because how's that? Is that written with an E?
Yeah, it's spelled B-A-K-E-L-I-T-E. But he pronounced it Baker-like. So,
I genuinely don't know how that's supposed to be pronounced. Old school.
He also says he loves the smell of letters, and sort of seems to kind of confuse his eras, because he's talking about wax seals on a letter as if they were rife in his day. But I mean, he's not that old. Surely wax and parchment predate Partridge by hundreds of years. So he's sort of imagining a history he didn't live through.
Yeah, I mean, there's some dispute over age, as we'll get into in the next few episodes, but not that much, definitely.
Yeah, I think unless he's sort of, 800 years old, that seems a bit of a stretch. Was anyone else with... Sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to kind of agree that, he talks about kind of the quills and well, he might have a Mont Blanc pen, to be fair. Did anyone kind of pick up on the Mid-Morning Matters kind of pop, pop, pop to the tap, tap, tap that we get in the Oast House?
Yeah, that's a good shout. Yeah.
Where he's kind of just like, he starts going on a bit of a tap thing, but he's just aimlessly rambling with it in the same way that he's kind of fizzing with ideas in Mid-Morning Matters, where he's, I think, is he talking to Craig, who's the manager of Mid-Morning Matters? Like, pop, 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 pop.
Did anybody have to look up the word olfactory as well in this point?
No, I was familiar with that one.
I'd never heard that word before, so that's the defined as it's basically the sense of smell. I did not know that word.
Pertaining to smell. Yeah. Was anybody else kind of with him when he was talking about how angry he gets at people that leave the ketones on their phone?
100%.
Also, quite happy that in real life he has provided people with a step-by-step guide of how to turn them off.
I thought that was quite good.
I've turned mine on. So mine
what?
Mine are now, when my phone is not on silent, which it is most of the time, it is not on silent, the clicks are enabled. So I will have clicks.
Why?
Because I quite like the sound of the clicks.
No one else does.
So you want that audible feedback?
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Well, keep your headphones on in that case.
The only people who actually have those on, apart from Nick, clearly for some weird reason, is people in films and TV, like to show that they are actually doing it. But
or maybe old women like Lynn. I'd imagine Lynn would like a keyboard.
You say Nick's like an old woman.
Yes, I think I probably am.
Yes, I think I am.
Actually,
like,
probably got
like Lynn because he likes tapping on his phone, like Rosa because he smashes plates everywhere he goes.
And I reckon Lynn would probably wear booties like Nick does as well. So yeah, I think it makes sense.
Have we done
and
a poll?
And is a fan of an early night.
No, we're not doing a poll.
Okay, fine.
He really forces in an Audible reference as well when he uses the word audibly, and this is brought to you by Audible, which doesn't make any sense, but fair enough.
I thought that was a mistake at first. It's so poorly woven into that audio, but I kind of thought it was a mistake.
I think deliberately so. That's a Pear Tree Productions hallmark, isn't it?
I actually just didn't know what to make of that. I genuinely thought it was a mistake. I thought it sounded a bit odd, but it kind of makes sense now you've explained it, and through the optics of poor Pear Tree Productions sound quality, but I wasn't sure what it was.
He also makes the point that the British have a fetish for being choked by the Americans culturally. I think there's some truth to that. I think there's quite a few bits that Partridge has said at the top of this episode that I agree with.
You know how everyone now calls it, instead of calling it like a TV series, it's called
seasons.
Yeah, that's what I'll come in with that.
Seasons, the sort of proms, Halloween. I mean, I like Halloween, but
absolutely.
To an extent. Just a few examples of American cultural imperialism for you there.
I really enjoyed the wording American English tightening its grip around the throat of British culture with little to no resistance. He doesn't just dislike American things, he hates American things.
Until seconds
until
later.
Until an episode later on in this series, which we'll get to.
Alan is inconsistent by his very nature.
Or even a section in this series where he's seconds later doing a twerk dat workout on YouTube. I mean, which country did he think that originated from? Simple gag, but a bit of fun.
Did anyone else look up twerk dat exercises?
Yes. No. I did on Spotify, actually. The results were unremarkable, but there were results.
So I think, is it worth saying? So basically the premise of this episode is Alan is setting out he's going to open his mail with us. Let us into that that routine. So can we do a recap at the end of this episode to see what insight we actually get? See what mail he actually goes through.
And also he seems to judge his mail by quantity rather than quality. He compares fanning out his letters to a trawlerman looking at a full net and thinking, I got those. I was a bit disturbed by the next crash that we hear from Rosa. She sounds genuinely distraught, like she's crying about the plate. And he does seem to have some sort of concern for her, but also more keen than anything to know if it's a good plate or not that she smashed.
Yeah, and did you know how she sounds so excited when he says, go and sit on the front step and have a cigarette? Yeah. You hear her say, can I?
Really?
That's Alan's absolute generosity, because he basically doesn't want to have to deal with the fact that she is crying.
Yes, and there's a nice bit where he's sort of, Rosa, it matters not one iota. And then as soon as she's out of earshot, he's like, it was one of the good ones.
Is it this point Alan is talking about his miniature cutlass letter opener? I remember I think my great uncle or somebody had a miniature Cutlass Lesser Opener. I remember being a small child and being obsessed with it, because like, that's great, that's like a tiny sword. Yeah, and probably much because, like Alan, it made me feel like a giant pirate.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone uses a letter opener in 2020, do they? Who has any kind of significant level of mail that they'd need an implement to open it? I mean, I try and avoid mail as much as I can.
Entirely fair.
I thought we got some prophetic COVID advice where Alan talked about not wanting to lick an envelope, which I thought seemed quite contextually relevant given the situation we're in at the moment, where he essentially says you should either be using pre-gummed envelopes or use a damp sponge like a postmistress.
Good advice.
Which, yeah, in 2020, feels even more relevant.
And then he uses his cutlass, arguably a relic of a bygone age, to open the first letter from Roy Hurst in Felixstowe, also arguably the relic of a bygone age. he's writing in to ask whether Alan thinks he's racist because he has racial preferences. He goes on to give a ranking in descending order, says it's not to do with hatred, simply preference. Alan is keen to kind of fold his advice or his response into a bit of a compliment sandwich here, isn't he?
I thought this, I don't know what anyone else thought about it, but this to me seemed like a slightly strange letter in and of itself anyway, because there can't be any kind of grey lines with it and there's not lots of humour to really draw out of it. I did like that kind of Alan's like, oh, I love the handwriting, and she said it's a bit of a compliment sandwich, but it did feel like even in an Alan world, there wasn't tons of humour to be drawn out of it, because you can't really find the shades of grey in this joke.
Well, I would say, I think the letter itself isn't that funny. Like the kind of the ranking of racial preferences, that almost felt a bit awkward in a 2020 lens. But I don't think that's really where the gag lies. I feel like the payoff is really all down to Alan's response. And I think there's actually quite a lot of detail to unpick in it, because it goes, his response, he goes through it quite fast. And I think there's actually quite a lot to go through. So if you'd allow me to go through my, I've got a 7-point response for this.
Wow, denial, shame,
yeah,
acceptance.
Basically, yeah. So, you know, number one, he praises the handwriting. Two, he's very clear that it's factually racist. Three, Roy includes a recipe for farmhouse fruitcake, so surely Alan could have just read that out instead. Be much more, a much more safer thing to read in the podcast. Four, Alan acknowledges his audience is a broad church, and this line is crucial. And like all churches, there are one or two racists who are normally sitting near the front. I thought that's basically Lynn's mum. five, this is a slight aside, but you know, there's a bit where Alan says, would that it were not so, but therefore it's all to see so, which is kind of broadly Shakespearean. I think that's kind of a bastardization of a line from Hamlet. It also made me think of, if you guys have seen the Coen brothers' film Hail Caesar, where they had that long exchange about would that it were not so, the back and forth with that, it just made me think of that.
Would that it were so simple?
That's the one. Would that it were so simple. Five, I liked Alan dispensing advice on how to be less racist. So
that
try as much as you can to be less racist.
Yeah,
start by not being racist one day a week, then two, then three. I thought, obviously, that is more appropriate advice you'd give to somebody who's trying to quit drinking or smoking. Although I thought it was kind of actually quite charming, because if only it were that easy for people to not be racist. Six, why did Roy even send Alan this letter in the first place? It's batshit. But obviously, I think the payoff there is a great depiction of Alan's listeners and fan base.
Yeah.
And then seven, there's a left turn of a mildly offensive payoff, but it's not along racial lines, because Alan then says calligraphy is the art of camp writing. So you've got all those things that actually play out probably in around a minute of dialogue from Alan responding to the letter. So I think the letter itself isn't that funny, but I think the way Alan deals with it is where the payoff is.
Yeah, it's what it lets them do as writers, isn't it?
Yes.
I suppose. Yeah, and I also like when you talk about the bit about trying to be less racist, it's that once you get to 3 days a week where you're not racist, then, as Alan says, you've broken the back of it.
Yeah. It's like when people say, like, if you're quitting smoking, like, the first 3 weeks are the hardest. It's that kind of thing. You get over the hump and then you'll be fine.
I like, on the subject of mail from other celebrities, he talks about getting a charity Christmas card from Anthea Turner that he found a bit preachy. I think there is a lot in this series where he's referring to other celebrities where the behaviour he's describing is kind of behaviour you can imagine coming from them. So when he talks about Edmonds, the way he talks about him, you can sort of imagine the things he says being true about Noel Edmonds. And similarly, when he says the Christmas card from Anthea Turner is a bit preachy, you're sort of like, yeah, I imagine a Christmas card from Anthea Turner probably would be.
You can allow it, though, Adam, because she is the Ford Cabriolet of middle-aged women.
Lovely. And he also does a recurring thing where, again, he tries to make an emoji gag that doesn't work and then says, I must do stand-up.
So I think it's almost like the second time we've heard him say must do stand-up.
Yeah.
And obviously that does come back a second.
No, third, I think, actually.
Yeah, second or third.
Third, I think.
But yeah, that comes back several times.
To the point where, I mean, I know he probably won't, but you almost imagine that a future episode of this would be him trying to do stand-up.
Yes. I had a note, before we move on, I had a note when Alan refers to, says much like St. Paul sending letters to the Corinthians. Now, I don't know if there's perhaps a more in-depth biblical joke there, because I don't know what the context would be. But obviously, I think the Gibbons and Coogan do have previous form with kind of religious, embedded religious gags. For example, with the resurrection being referenced at the end of Mid-Morning Matters Series 2 with the stigmata palms and the 3 p.m. doctor's appointment on a Friday, which obviously Stephen Mangan had to explain to us. So yeah. If there is a gag there that we haven't picked up on, please do let us know.
We'll just get in touch with Stephen Mangan. He'll tell us.
he'll know.
I love that Alan claims to adore books but then struggles to recount the plot of Pride and Prejudice, perhaps one of the most famous books available.
He clearly hasn't read it, has he?
No. There's a nice bit of world building where he talks about how Carol's life has fallen apart, which I really enjoyed. So we learn that he's kept letters from Carol, but primarily because he knows that she'd hate that more than if he burned them, and that her life has fallen apart. Her fitness instructor has dumped her for a younger model, which I think is something we had predicted on a previous episode before we had it confirmed. And at one point she offered to go for a coffee with him, and I wondered, did this actually happen? It sounds like it actually might have done. She might have fallen to that low.
I could imagine that if Carol has gone off with a fitness instructor and has then been promptly dumped, you know, after a fairly short period of time, and she's left her husband and her home, she probably thinks, oh, it's worth one spin of the dice. I'll see if he wants to go for a coffee and see what happens from there. But I kind of thought, fair play to Alan for, you know, saying, nah, like...
Yeah, I was on Alan's side for that. I thought, yeah, good on you.
Yeah, at the end of the day, she did choose to leave him, and it's probably not easy for him. So, yeah, fair play to him if he just said, no, Carol, you're all right. Although when we come to the grandkids episode, interesting to see how where the family lies in terms of their ties to Carol or Alan. Alan definitely kind of losing out on that front.
He's then talking about being in the pub with his mates Daniel Flench and Craig Savage again, and I noticed the return of Gembling, which we've talked about a lot more. Yeah. Ho ho, tis the wending hour, etc., etc. So the slightly gross practice of men trying to speak to each other and also trying to chat up women using sort of archaic medieval language.
Well, he describes it as a florid style of prose, doesn't he? Full of forsooths and betwixts.
And Daniel Flench and Craig Savage pop up
Daryl Flench, sorry, yes.
A regular characters now. Almost kind of filling a Pete Gabbitas hole now that Pete is sadly no longer with us.
You will be missed.
Nick, as our resident Daryl Flench expert, do you have any intel on Craig Savage? Has he been mentioned before as well? I wasn't sure about that.
Not that I can recall.
Disappointing.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Although to be clear, you said he was a Daryl Flench expert, not an expert on what was the name of the other guy?
Craig Savage.
Yeah. I'm assuming these two come as a pair. I'm imagining it's a kind of David Brent Finchy type thing going on here.
But I think the Daryl Flench joke is always that he's with his friend. So it's Daryl Flench and his friend. So. The other person
so that
is often
could be
unnamed.
Craig Savage.
It could be, but yeah. The gag with Daryl Flench is, who is the other person? We don't know. Like, and that's the joke, isn't it? Because if you're going to lunch with Daryl Flench and his friend, you would name the friend, but yeah. He doesn't know who this person is. And yeah. Yet now they're constantly referring to him as Daryl Flench and his friend, despite the fact that Alan's probably met him more than once.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Do we have the four-step guide to how Lynn wheedles out any abusive mail to Alan?
Yep, I've got that. I can go through that.
Does it stink?
Bin it. If it's written in block caps, bin it. Any spelling mistakes on the envelope, bin it. If it's addressed to Partridge or Mr. Partridge, bin it.
final check was... Oh, yeah, sorry, smell it. Yeah, that came first. Yeah. The most important. Yeah.
Does it stink?
And the reason that he doesn't trust mail that's just addressed to Partridge rather than Alan Partridge or Mr. A. Partridge is that farmers and Labour Party sympathisers use your surname and it means they want to hurt you, which is a lovely bit of Alan, yes, Coogan, no.
And also, of course, it's that the kind of example that we see in I'm Alan Partridge of the farmer shouting, Partridge, you wanker. They'll never give him the formality of the first name.
Can we pause for a moment about those from the Norwich business community that we've lost this year? And does anyone have a view or perspective as to why that section or sting kind of existed and why the list of names goes on for so long?
No.
Okay, great. As you were. I think Seldom comes in at this point, Adam.
Yes, Seldom pipes up at the mention of spam. And what I like is Alan's lack of understanding of dogs and their relationship to language. He thinks that he can keep saying the word spam, but calm Seldom down by saying, no spam, no spam, as if the word no is going to be understood. But clearly Seldom's just going mad at the repeated use of the word spam because he thinks there's spam in the cupboard.
We also didn't mention just quickly Alan's post bag is an old brown bean bag. I wonder if he's repurposed a bean bag he used to watch Nazi megastructures on, perhaps.
Quite possibly, yes. And it seems that he's sent a lot of repurposed gifts as well. He mentions a jiffy bag containing a knitted iPhone case in black wool that he was sent from Dawn in Halifax, which he doesn't use because he doesn't want his phone to look like a member of the IRA, although he does say he once met Gerry Adams and he seemed all right.
So this is a weird one. I couldn't really, apart from, I guess, obviously a gag lies in terms of he's just been sent some mail, which is quite odd. But it's like, it doesn't really link to anything, does it, specifically? Like, and also, a knitted iPhone case. What the hell is that?
They are available. I did look them up. You can get them on Etsy. It's basically just like a knitted sock.
Like
it kind of looks like a knitted
window.
Sock. Yeah, exactly.
In the writer's defence, that seems exactly like the sort of gift that a North Norfolk Digital listener would make and post in for Alan.
And to be fair, remember when the iPhone launched and they had those knitted socks that you used to be able to get? I used to use those all the time.
Oh, for iPods.
Right.
Yeah, but that's the thing. That would cover the whole thing. For an iPhone, that's no use.
This is exactly the sort of thing that I would describe as Facebook Marketplace fodder.
Agreed. Yeah.
Oh, what's this piece of shit? I don't know. I'll just send it to Alan Partridge instead.
There's quite a lot of chat about a subject that I was hoping would come up in an episode called Letters, which is about the begging letters that Alan gets from people, sort of asking for money or asking for support. One example he gave is that somebody wrote claiming to be the child of one of the makeup artists that worked with him on Knowing Me, Knowing You. So, a tie across the Partridge universe. She'd become depressed and could he send a signed photo? He's very dubious about this, which I think would be fair if she was asking for sums of money, but he's literally asking for him to write his name on a photo and send it. How hard would that have been?
Yeah, because you have an actual, well, arguably you have a begging letter just before that one, don't you, where he goes, oh, here we go, rare blood disease, operation in Florida, blah, blah, blah. So So, you know, that is somebody actually asking for a donation. But yeah, this follow-up letter, it's just for him to sign a photo, which, you know, shouldn't really be that much of a hardship. And actually, you'd think that he'd be pleased that somebody was asking for him to sign something. Like, that's a validation of his celebrity.
I thought very the audio true. Production was exceptionally good as well, with the just like the reading and the scrunching and the clear throwing of the letter. It really kind of accentuated that gag.
I had a note as well when he says back in the 90s Britpop etc. good days. I thought it was quite an interesting line, because it's a bit of throwaway, but it's like, is that kind of him trying to make out like he loved the 90s because he thinks it's an en vogue thing to do? But when you think about it in terms of the character, considering the 90s is when his marriage fell apart, he shot a man dead on live TV, he lived in a hotel for over half a year and began a raging chocolate addiction, it probably wasn't his best decade, to be fair. He was yet to bounce back.
Has he had a good decade?
That's true. Although I would argue that it's also when he probably had, you know, apart from the This Time comeback, his biggest decade in terms of success is when he was TV Quick's Man of the Moment, or Man of the Moment. It's when he was on TV probably the majority out of the decade so
and
far.
I guess those things would outrank the fact his marriage fell apart for him.
I think there's a bit of revisionist history here where he's sort of pretending that, you know, he was almost part of Britpop, when in fact, when you think about the way that he interviewed Noel Gallagher, he was distinctly unimpressed at the time.
And he was not a fan of Shane McGough either.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. So I think High Noon features again, probably one of the most regular featuring characters of the series, his internet troll, who implies that Alan has a little secret sexually. And then Alan protests this for so long, it seems like he's hit a nerve. I mean, I was kind of in two minds about whether High Noon actually knows something here or whether it's just winding Alan up.
Well,
yeah,
I think it's probably a bit of a stab in the dark, because most people probably have a secret, and I'm pretty sure that Alan has a lot of secrets or things that he feels uncomfortable about. So the fact that you can just kind of throw that out there and put Alan, you know, off guard is probably what he's doing.
Oh, that's just reminded me. I don't think this is something official. I think it's a fan doing this, but somebody has started a High Noon Twitter account. I think it's called @NoMorePartridge.
Okay.
So they're making out like they're properly stalking him. Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing.
I do like High Noon's little dig at Alan, because it works on a couple of levels. The fact that he says he sounds like Nicholas Witchell. Now,
is that
Alan's
the second Nicholas Witchell mention?
Not sure. But Alan's reply to that is, Nick Witchell remains one of the finest broadcasters on God's green earth. His commitment to his job as the BBC's royal correspondent is unimpeachable. Not only does that man love the royal family, he loves them in full knowledge that they cannot stand him. Now, there is some truth in that when looking at Nicholas Witchell's Wikipedia page. Prince Charles famously said of him, "I can't bear that man. I mean, he's so awful, he really is." And in 2002, his obituary of Princess Margaret, recorded sometime after her death, but screened immediately after the announcement of her death, was reportedly not well received by Buckingham Palace, as it mentioned her lovers and copious consumption of whiskey.
Oh, brilliant. God.
This is the second Nicholas Witchell mentioned in this series, because I remember reading that Wikipedia page. That's right. When he talked about him like collecting butterflies. So it's it's a bit weird, because... Yeah, I guess they could have chosen someone else, but I guess it doesn't matter.
Did anyone hear Alan uses the line "common" and "scamsters," but seems to say "scampsters"? Did anyone pick up on that? from the kind of Dracula, Nesquilk, scampsters?
There's loads of that throughout this series, which I think quite often you won't even notice it on the first time you're listening through. I'm detecting these things on a second and third listen.
I would actually, I'd love to know the list of all of these things, because I guarantee, as you say, we've probably missed a lot of them, because sometimes they're quite difficult to hear, or you'll hear them on a second listen, or, you know, a third or fourth or whatever. But I'd love to see that full list of all of those kind of mispronunciations that they've kind of weaved into the Partridge narrative.
So it's time for the last letter of the episode, I believe. Does anyone have the detail of this one?
So it's a tweet from a listener of Alan's called, or a fan of Alan's, don't know, called Mike Sutton. And it's actually a letter from his grandfather that he wants to sort of send to Alan, which, and in 2004, his grandfather was placed in a home and then one day received a letter about the kindness of the staff and the activities. And then there was an arrow in the margin. And Mike says that the grandfather that we all knew was still there because the first letter of each sentence spelled out, "Get me out of here. These people are cunts." Which, the delivery of cunts from Steve/Alan is so good.
It's perfect.
It's so perfect. I listened to it about 3 or 4 times in a row, to be honest.
He's so satisfied. Every single time. He's so satisfied with it, isn't he?
Yeah. He doesn't even pause. He just goes straight. He doesn't even go, "Oh, no, that's a bit." He just goes, "Cunts."
And the way it sort of sits, obviously, as the payoff to what was supposedly a very heartwarming story about, you know, they thought that his, you know, the grandfather had really, was really kind of losing his way mentally.
That was it,
Still there, because he's called the people at the home cunts.
And yeah, I enjoyed that Alan just says, "How lovely, what a lovely note to end on." Okay, so guys, can I recap the mail that Alan has gone through in today's episode?
What have we learned? What knowledge have we gained?
Let's see what insight we can take from Alan's mailbag here. Okay, so 1, a racist letter, which is read out in full. 2, some junk mail that he gets annoyed with and doesn't go through in any detail. 3, a knitted iPhone case. 4, a fan asking for donations for an operation. 5, the son of a former colleague asking for a signed photo for his mum. 6, a letter from his troll. 7, a tweet, so not even a letter. So when you break it down, it's actually only one proper letter read out in full in 20 minutes, which is exactly the sort of success rate I'd come to expect from Alan. So fair enough.
And I think that brings us to the next episode, one that is very high in drama and subtitled Break-In, opening with Alan going, "Show yourself, let's have a fight." He says, "It's a live testimony. I have been and may still be the victim of a home invasion." And then he goes on to mangle a line about a bee. In three different ways. "I'm scarier than a bee than you. I mean, I'm more scared of a bee than you."
Brilliant. Love that.
That line as well at the beginning where it's like, "Show yourself, let's have a fight. I'll smash your head." Not smash your head in, it's just, "I'll smash your head." And the delivery of that is so wild and frantic that you can tell Alan is genuinely shaken by this potential break-in. Like, High Noon has definitely rattled him.
So it's quite a fun start because it's a cold open and it is quite frantic like that. And Alan, so yeah, basically Alan thinks he's subject to a home invasion. But then he says it's 10:12, which I presume means 10:12 in the morning. And I did think, well, that seems a bit odd for Alan to be encountering a potential intruder. But I did check this, and apparently 65% of burglaries occur between 6 a.m. and 6 p.m. So,
wow,
quite likely.
I thought his state of mind in this as well reminded me a lot of when he went dumpster diving in, I think it's Scissored Isle.
Freegan.
And then the Freegan runs and he gets trapped in the warehouse overnight, doesn't he? And has to make himself a sort of a
Scottish widow from bubble wrap.
Exactly. Google it. Yeah. I felt like this is a very similar level of fight or flight we get from Alan here.
And also the thing is, if you're suspecting that your house is being invaded, definitely record a podcast.
Yeah,
and well, I think, a good idea.
I think that's true to form for what Alan's character would do, though. Like, if he can capitalise on it and broadcast it, then he's going to take that opportunity. He's armed himself with a rolled-up newspaper.
So we learn the reason that he's on high alert is that he's received a letter from a man he believes is High Noon, Alan's troll, and it wasn't stamped, and so he's responded by carrying a rolled-up newspaper in order to try and affect High Noon's spatial awareness if attacked.
Yes, he's going to poke him in the eye.
I did quite like the detail that he never gives out his home address, not even to taxi drivers. He gets them to drop him at a farm and then he runs across a field.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
I did enjoy, so after the kind of initial intro that we kind of cut to him kind of in the Oast House, and he's almost like, he's calming down with a cup of options and his trotters are in a foot spa.
Trotters, that is specifically like, trotters, yeah.
His sort of version of meditation is emptying his mind of anything controversial or interesting and imagining a bland garden.
Thought that reminded me of Let Go with Alan Partridge from I'm Alan Partridge. Remember the breathing techniques from tape one.
Yeah.
did you spot he's slurping away at his couple options, even though in the previous episode he said that he never slurps?
Oh,
great spot.
Yeah, that is a good spot. Very good.
So the reason that his panic is heightened is that High Noon traditionally to this point has emailed or sent letters via the BBC, but this one's come direct, and he's used the word misunderestimate, which Alan laughs at, and he says that High Noon puts a line through his sevens, which beggars belief. And so Alan kind of makes peace with these letters up until now by skewering them on a spike. Nice spike callback.
The thing about the sevens, he says he's doing that like he's French. Is that a French thing?
It's a continental seven.
Because I do lines on my sevens. I didn't know that was considered continental or French.
We're very continental people,
clearly.
Tom.
Yeah.
The letter was on his doorstep. Initially, he hoped it was the invite to the launch of a big car. That's the criteria. As long as the car's big, he'll be there. I also really liked his description where he says that the writing was as higgledy as it was pickledy.
Yeah, he says as well, this trolls campaign against me is something to enjoy or mock, like Nigel Slater's parallel parking. I think that's another classic example where they've gone, what celebrity name can we insert here that's going to be funniest? Like, that's such an odd reference choice.
I hope they have a two bowls and one's just got a load of random names in and the other one's got a load of random actions in this. But Nigel Slater trying to parallel park.
Some sort of Alan Partridge celebrity rumour generator. Someone should make one online.
They've got Nick Knowles, Eamon Holmes, Nicholas Witchell, Nigel Slater. They're all in there. Yeah.
I feel a little bit like this episode. It's almost like they wrote the previous episode and then this was just a natural lead on because it's still about, a lot of it's about mail. So he gives, for example, he gives a detail that he always slices letters away from the face in case of anthrax or sneezing powder. Sounds like, I can imagine, he's probably never had anthrax sent to him, but I can imagine maybe in the BBC days, one of his colleagues playing a practical joke.
No, that's a very specific callback to Nomad. He has an anthrax scare in Nomad.
Of course he does.
Because he's from sent him a CD. Music, but but he doesn't understand. Yeah.
I did enjoy, I'm not sure if we should probably get into the detail of the letter. I kind of enjoyed it being called From the Outhouse. Yes. And Alan kind of having to like almost, you hear Alan kind of live processing the joke, which I thought was very good.
You know, my notes next to that, I literally have just written, enjoyed. It's such a basic gag, but every time I listened, it really made me laugh.
He briefly imagines how he might adapt to life as a woman, which is almost a call forward to something that is the bulk of a future episode we'll get onto.
Yep.
And he's quite defensive of automatic cars, and I'm with him as an automatic driver. Why
I was surprised by this. I would never have Alan down as an automatic driver. I thought he would always be a kind of gear shift guy.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I was surprised too, but glad that he's gone down that route.
When he goes off on one, imagining what he would do if he were a woman, how he'd adapt, how he'd dress, I thought it was interesting when he says, I've got a nice back, which begs the question, has he lost the build-up of fatty deposits just above the belt line? Because years ago, he had a fat back, not a nice back.
That's
Something's
true.
Changed.
Maybe it's all those widths at the pool. and he sort of imagine he likes to get into imagined arguments. Is this the bit where he sort of imagines the kind of threatening High Noon? He says, I know people, big loyal boys who've done menial work in my garden, happy to earn £500 for an extra 15 minutes work.
I did like the kind of payoff as well there when he says one of them isn't all there and he once saw him brain a rabbit with a pan.
And I think that this also might be another kind of through line to the later Dreams episode, because there is a local kind of farmhand, or is it a delivering milk or something, that appears in that episode.
Yeah.
I'm assuming that's one of the big loyal boys.
Maybe this is going to be we'll kind of leave you aghast in the same way that my request for talking about the fallen business leaders from Norwich, but I have the same kind of question about being smart, lawnmower smart. Like, what was this all about? Like, I feel like some of these like stings or kind of like false adverts are ludicrous, and this is one of the most ludicrous.
I suspect the reason that he is imploring people to, if you must strim, strim safe, is not that anyone's asked him to do it, but I think it's probably he's watched enough TV or listened to enough radio to know that if you've got space in your product for ads and you don't have enough ads, then what you'll often do is offer them out to a charity. And I think he hasn't bothered to do that, but he's just thought about what are things that I think are important, e.g., be improper lawnmower use, and then he's kind of created his own public service announcement as if he's doing it on behalf of someone else, but actually it's just something that he wants to put out there, that if you must strim, strim safe.
And I agree with Alan, because from an article that I researched on lawnmower injuries, according to an article in The Telegraph, lawnmower-related injuries see 6,500 admissions to A&E every year.
That is all good and well, and fair enough, well argued, well justified. But one of Alan's points is, in this incredibly short segment, is lay off the booze. as if you need to be told to basically not drink whilst you're doing the gardening.
Is it time for the phone call with Lynn next? Because yes. That is my absolute highlight of this episode, and I think one of my favourite exchanges of the series.
I'm loving the way that they leave you to imagine Lynn's reaction on the other end of the line. Yeah.
Yeah. She's Lynn's character is such a strong presence throughout the series without actually being heard. Like, because the thing is, you don't need to hear her side of the conversation with Alan to know what she's saying to him. Like, you can basically hear it with your mind's eye.
So let's start with the premise of this, which is ludicrous to begin with. He doesn't know where his own rolling pin is, so he's called her to find out where his rolling pin is kept, because presumably she does all of the sort of pastry rolling, you know, whatever. And he doesn't know where it is in his own house.
And then you've got him going, Lynn, calm down, you're getting me frothy now. So Lynn's rather overexcited on the other end of the phone as well, because it... And doesn't it transpire she's getting her hair done at the church?
Yes, which means she's also then returned Alan's call mid-haircut.
Yes.
So presumably she's got a phone to her ear while someone is working around it.
Yeah, hadn't thought about the practicalities of that. Yeah. So then you hear Alan say, he says to her, why would they come after you? No one knows who you are. I love the way that he's always putting her down in quite subtle and discreet ways as well. It's like he doesn't need to say that, but obviously... because of their relationship he has. And then they're going on to the, what were the woman at the church? Christ. Sorry. She's doing biscuits and flour. She's on your patch. You're going to have to do something. So we get it's where they start planting the seed that Lynn is in some kind of church group dispute of some nature.
Yes. And I really liked how specific he was about how to undermine her rival at the church. Initially just saying... sabotage her process or make better biscuits, and then eventually suggesting that what she does is uses the woman's biscuits to make a cheesecake, and then when she brings it in, go, oh yeah, I did use your biscuits, I wanted to make something special. And then they go into quite a weird exchange where basically it emerges that they both understand the term negging, and that that's what they're trying to do to the rival at the church, is to sort of undermine her with a better baked good.
I love that, because Alan says to her, how do you know about negging? I just thought you talked about the Bible at coffee mornings. And then the way they wrap up this conversation, you have Alan says, I've got to go, and then a slight pause and says, I don't need a reason. I love the implication that Lynn has asked him why he's got to end the call. That's brilliant.
Yep. She's got just the right level of sass, but is always overruled. It's great.
Yeah.
So he's then distracted because someone's in the house. He starts to whisper. I thought his whispering is really odd and very deep and quite funny. Mm. The tone he uses is great. And also his sort of strategies, like, creeks are good. I know where the creeks are. The burgers don't know where the creeks are.
So you have at this section, he's heard a noise, and you kind of hear one of these background noises. So I made a note at 11 minutes 36 when I think what it's supposed to be is supposed to just be a background noise. But to me, I would swear it actually sounds like a voice. So take your time and go back to that and see what you think you hear. But to me, it doesn't sound like a creak. It actually sounds like it is a voice, like, which is cut in as a bad edit. I'm sure that's not actually the case, but. It sounds odd to me.
Quite strange as well that his solution to once doing a wee in his pyjama bottoms after playing a cross the landing with no creaks game is that he now sleeps bottomless. Hard to see how that would make the situation any better or safer or drier.
And because also, it felt really nice, Adam. That's why.
Yeah, I think he likes the freedom of the medium.
And crossing the landing without touching the squeaky boards I mean, I was playing that probably when I was about 7 years old.
Yeah.
Like, yes, that's a familiar game, but not when you're kind of like, what, late 50s, early 60s.
Well, his OCD is out of control.
So he then goes into quite a long ramble about a washing machine and tumble dryer,
oh, God,
and
suddenly, yeah.
suddenly seems far more interested in finishing that story than actually listening out for his intruder.
That's a good point. That's mid-potential intruder, and he just goes off on one.
I'd put at this point as well that surely the intruder is Seldom. That was my guess at this stage of the game.
I mean, it's more likely. It's pretty apparent that someone hasn't broken in, and we know that Seldom kind of... in effect kind of haunts the premises by going wherever he pleases, and it's probably more likely that it's Seldom than anyone else.
I like that Alan kind of G's himself up, then he's like, he says, I'm not a chicken, I'm Partridge, I'm game, okay, let's roll, and then it cuts to theme. It's a bit of a tense moment, like what's going to happen next, there's some action, and then it comes back and it's 10 hours later.
Yeah, he also just before that point says, there comes a time in your life when you're not running anymore. And you think he's sort of showing genuine flashes of bravery, but also, as we've seen before, seems to have learnt all of his skills from watching films. So all of his phrasing about sort of G'ing himself up is all stuff that basically sounds like it came from a movie.
Oh, yeah, like, OK, let's roll. That's straight out of like an action film he's been watching, isn't it?
Yes. So, yes, 10 hours later.
Which does that mean that does that mean then that he is now recording the podcast at 3 a.m.? Because it started at when he first heard the intruder, it was...
Unless it was evening, and then it would make more sense.
No, this doesn't make sense, because at the very top of the episode, he says it's 10:12, which, work on the basis it's 10:12 a.m.
Why does it have to be a.m.?
Well, okay, but either way, when you get to the point in the episode where he first hears the noise in the house, you've heard the clock chime 5 times. So it doesn't add up.
But yeah, 10 hours later, Alan's tripped over a curtain, he gets tangled in it, and then just falls asleep. Might as well go to sleep.
Absolutely defeated.
He says it's the best night's sleep he's had in years.
I think he says best day's sleep, doesn't he? So that might make more sense, yeah.
Emerges that actually the noise was not even as significant as Seldom. It was just the toilet flapping his blind in his bathroom. But he has still had a hand-delivered letter, which is slightly unnerving. He says that he has chatted to an injury lawyer since he was recording the last segment of the podcast, and so he has to retract his chat about attacking someone with a newspaper. And then there's a bit where he talks about, in terms of spatial awareness, the difference between small and close versus big and far away, which felt like almost a direct lift of the well-known Father Ted sketch.
But I like that he used Kylie as the example for depth of field, because she's not far away, she's small and close. And the way that he'd dispatch of her, that he'd grab the hood of her parka and swing her into a pond. That was a lovely image.
He tries to disparage High Noon, who sent the letter, by saying that he lives with his mum. That's something he keeps referring to. But also, crucially, believes that he drives a car with a 1.2-litre engine, which in Alan's world is a significant insult.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's the second time he mentions the engine size. And he also guesses that High Noon probably lives in Swindon, which wouldn't actually make any sense if he's just hand-delivered a letter in Norwich.
Very true. Is it time to not name Ross Kemp?
Yes.
He says he's not. He's describing someone. He says he's not going to name names, but it's a former presenter of Ross Kemp on Gangs. It's one of my favourite lines.
Yeah, so good.
And kind of a repeat of the gag we've seen in I, Man and Partridge, when he doesn't name Domingo from Little Oakley, won't give us his surname, but really great. He says that he called Ross Kemp an SAS walnut, not to his face, mentioned that his trunks were too small, and then basically realises that he's effectively told you it's Ross Kemp.
I like the inclusion of SAS, because it's just Super Army Soldiers from Extras again, isn't it?
Yep.
It's time for another one of Alan's sort of public service announcements, isn't it? This time, cancer-related. Check your balls, check the inside of your bum. I thought it was a great take on the idea that, like, any messaging that has to be targeted at men, like for prostate cancer and stuff, they have to sort of beef it up or, like, put it through a lad filter. Men won't possibly understand the importance of it unless you're sort of like, yeah, cars, girls, check your balls, lads, like awful kind of basic shit.
But do check your bum and balls, basically. That's message
over.
Check your bum and balls.
Given our listenership is about 80, 90% male, guys, please do check your balls and your bum. Just had to say that.
And once you've done that, you can join us with Alan in his security room.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, where he's chatting about why bird's eye view is overrated. You just want to be lower down.
I did enjoy where he's obviously got a significant security setup, which is not as a result of this activity with High Noon, but the fact that he'd seen what a crow with a bag of crisps on its head or something, and he'd aimed 9 cameras at it to see if it did something funny or flew off into a telegraph pole,
and it got nothing.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that. Just the idea that he needed all 9 cameras on it and the fact that he would find that funny as well.
I think so. The security room, he's got an alarm control pad, monitors for a security camera, a nightstick, sadly not a Danko nightstick. And then, yeah, like Adam said, he goes off on one about he's at pains to explain that none of his cameras are positioned anywhere sordid, but then goes on to explain in very precise detail where and how he would find it best to perv on someone using cameras in the shower.
Yeah.
So he's definitely thought it through.
I also enjoyed computer enhance, and then he realises that there is no ability to speak to it.
He hasn't got the tech.
Yeah.
It's another life reference acquired through Hollywood.
Yeah.
This is the point where effectively From the Oast House becomes a true crime podcast, isn't it? It starts to pipe in the true crime music, starts to describe things with an American accent, £180. And I thought this is really great, and I would have loved a bit more of a pastiche of genre podcasting from the Oast House. But I suppose because this is so kind of mainstream, this is probably the first introduction for a lot of Partridge fans to podcasting. I imagine if he did too much stuff where he's sort of making fun of genres of podcast, it might go over a lot of people's heads.
And then the other thing is that, you know, maybe they don't want to go too far down that route because there are plans for a second series that might actually be a true crime themed podcast where they go on the search for Michael.
Oh, so if there's a searching for Michael podcast, I'm so keen on that.
So keen.
Oh, yeah. Interviewing members of his family. You can imagine there's so many directions they could take it.
But I was going to say, I do think this kind of pastiche of true crime podcasts is quite effectively and efficiently done, and because you've kind of got these 3 points where he ruins any of the potential tension of the moment by explaining that he's going to bring the tense music in, which then comes in. I really enjoyed the fact that he declares it's transitioned to a successful podcast. It's like, that's not for him to say. And then finally, I love that he takes the cliffhanger trope of a true crime podcast far too literally by ending the episode with half a sentence. A build-up about what's going to happen next week. You literally get the person that posted the letter was, and it ends.
And the end.
Yeah, it's far too literal.
Yes, and so yes, that is the end of the break-in episode and the end of this week's episode of Monkey Tennis. Thank you so much for joining us. If you've got any theories or suggestions or things that you hope that Alan will do next in podcast form or in other forms, we're on Instagram at Monkey Tennis Pod, Twitter at ThePartridgePod, Facebook.com/ThePartridgePod, email ThePartridgePod@gmail.com, and you can leave us a WhatsApp voice note on 07923 600 017. That's the Monkey Tennis hotline, and we may use it in a future show. If you'd like to shout us a coffee, you can go to ko-fi.com/monkeytennis and do that there. We appreciate all donations. We'll be back next week with more from the Oast House, including Alan's time capsule, but from all of us at Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge Fan Podcast. For now, thanks and goodbye.
Check your balls, check your bum.
And this is the beauty of podcasting, the freedom of the medium.
Kukumpa.
Monkey tennis?
Bring, bring!
Fireworks. Dumma kebab.
Trees are my pawn.
Monkey tennis?
Ready, steady, fuck off.
Scratch me!
Are you being served?
Monkey tennis?
Excuse me, your dog's taken my dog's stick.
With a chuckle, with a chuckle.
Monkey tennis?
Yup, absolutely. Yup, 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 absolutely.
Generally, I think new ideas are bad.
Monkey tennis?
Why not consider chips?
You must come and stay in the barn. Fuck off.
Riddle me that, you nutters. Nothing refreshes like an ice-cold glass of milk.
Monkey tennis?
From the Oast House.
Keep it down, love.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen,
premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.